And now for some Mariah Carey. All I want for Christmas.
I mean, if I could actually do her little arias, it's like I would try to do that, but it would be horrendous, so I'm not going to do it.
No, please don't.
Welcome to the Geek in Review, the podcast designed to cover the legal information profession with a slant toward technology and management. I'm Marlene Gaybauer.
And I'm Greg Lambert.
Well, we have a hot off the press interview today with Professor Benjamin Barton from the University of Tennessee, literally. Ben has a brand new book that just released this week called Fixing Law Schools, From Collapse to the Trump Bump and Beyond. There's been a bit of buzz about this book onto Twitter, Greg. Uh-huh. People are asking if anybody knows about it and, you know, should they get it? You know, we at the Geek in Review are very happy to deliver an overview from the author himself.
So wait a minute, you called it Da Twitter?
Da Twitter. And Greg, we should note that to the listeners that Ben's a prolific writer. Mm-hmm. His other books are The Lawyer Judge Bias in the American Legal System, Glass Half Full, The Decline and Rebirth of the Legal Profession, and Rebooting Justice with Stefanos Bibas. So listeners, you have a cycle of Ben Barton books to peruse, just in time for the holidays.
Absolutely. A potential gift for any of your legal nerd friends out there, Marlene.
And speaking of nerd friends and nerdy things, it's time for this week's Information Inspirations. Now, we're only doing one inspiration each this week because both of us still have to go shopping, and I have a road trip to plan, and more on that next episode.
Yeah, so this is the short and sweet holiday version of the inspirations.
Very good. I read something, and I really hope we get some feedback on this. The question posed in the article written by Sean Dexter is whether wireframes are still relevant. Not the glasses, Greg, you hipster, but the outline or skeleton of a web page. You've seen these, usually black and white with boxes signifying content sets, very lo-fi in terms of design, and a lot of lorem ipsum written all over the place. Mm-hmm. Now, wireframes have been used to show stakeholders how a website would function and be used. Why? Well, you know, they're easy and quick to produce, and they pretty much eliminate design elements so that they don't distract from the usability discussion. What Sean argues is that using wireframes up front is basically old school now, given the rise of agile product development and lean UX. Hmm. And you thought lean was just for project management.
I did.
And also some of the tech solutions that are out there now, which can quickly approximate high fidelity visuals, which I think makes a lot of sense. If you can sit with a stakeholder and quickly assess usability requirements and modify visual design elements on the fly, it eliminates a lot of steps and allows you to deal with stakeholder feedback up front. Now, Sean does note in some instances that wireframes still make a lot of sense. For example, a mobile game that's visually complex and that you need to work out the interaction independent of a very long art process. But again, as tech and process improve, they impact how we interact when designing. And Greg, he referenced some of these products like ThinkSketch and Figma, and they seem pretty cool.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, I think a lot of times you have to give, especially attorneys, something visual to see.
Indeed.
All right. Well, Marlene, my information inspiration is, you know, it's that time of the decade where we all look back as make a few predictions of what's to come. Aderant compiled its third annual Legal Tech and Business of Law Predictions and pulled together 25 thought leaders and their predictions of what 2020 has to offer. The overall theme I found on the predictions was that it was time to stop talking the talk and start walking the walk. Even our fellow geek Toby Brown got in on the action and mentioned that it is time to narrow our innovative ideas and focus on actually implementing and accomplishing something innovative. So imagine that. I think there has been a lot of talk over the past 2 or 3 years and not a lot of results. And so almost every one of the 25 predictions was like, okay, stop, and do something.
You know, I always wonder because, you know, how much, you know, is there innovation? Are we just talking about innovation? Are, you know, are organizations really innovating and just sort of not telling anybody to get a competitive advantage? You know, I wonder.
Yeah. Well, I've heard some of the talk of innovation as the cross street between PR and BS. So, there's a number of great ideas on the list of 25, so go check it out. But I wanted to add number 26 to the list. So, I mean,
you have one of your own. Okay.
They didn't ask me, but, you know, that's never stopped me.
No, that's true.
So I think there's a big push coming for collaborative software that focuses on the communication needs of the teams that we have in law firms. And that could be whether this is the overall practice area team, it could be a client team, a matter team, the administrative team, you know, the list goes on. So new products that are entering the market, and you see things from Microsoft like Teams, appropriately named. Mm-hmm. There's another product that I have looked at called WorkStorm that I think would help fill this need. And what we do is we need to take the silos that we have from emails and voice messages and text and instant messaging and file folders and all these communication tools and create a single user platform that makes it easier to collaborate, to communicate, and to store this information in a way that makes sense to the overall team members. And I think this is going to be the big breakthrough in the legal market in 2020 and beyond. So as the guy from Men's Warehouse says, I guarantee it. All right. Well, that wraps up this week's holiday version of Information Inspirations. Well, Marlene, this decade has been what our guest called the lost decade for law schools in the U.S. Ben Barton from the University of Tennessee Law School discusses what happened to law schools over the past 10 years or so and what he thinks needs to happen over the next decade to put law schools back on track and reestablish itself into the fabric of American society.
Yeah, Ben has some really interesting ideas, and I do hope that this sparks some discussion, you know, whether it's call-ins or whether it's on Twitter, because I think the topic is ripe for that.
We are joined today by Professor Ben Barton from the University of Tennessee School of Law. Hey, Ben, good to have you on the show.
Yeah, Ben.
Thanks for having me.
So, Ben, you're a prolific writer, and you have a new book that is literally hot off the presses. We wanted to talk to you about this book, but before we get started, I did want to note something about the titles of your books, and that is that, man, they're kind of depressing. So let me just read them out and get your feedback on them. So
there's a lead in right there.
Yeah. So you have three other books. You have the Lawyer Judge Bias in the American Legal System. You have The Glass Half Full, The Decline and Rebirth of the Legal Profession. And you have Rebooting Justice, which you did with Stefanos Bibas. Did I say that right?
That's how you pronounce it. Yep.
And now your latest book is Fixing Law Schools, From Collapse to Trump Bump and Beyond. So I just really want to start off. Are there no happy tales in the genre of the American legal system?
So first, I'm a law professor and I grade on a curve. I feel like you're being ungenerous. It's called glass half full. There's something in the glass.
Well played.
And
very good.
We've got the word bump there, right? You know, like there's at least something to look at. If you squint a little bit, you can see.
There we go.
No, but all right. I will say if you've been carefully watching what's gone on in the legal profession and or in law schools since 2008, you know, it's hard. If you've written a cheerful book over that period, then you're probably not watching too carefully.
And it might be fiction, huh?
Yeah.
But seriously, your latest book, Fixing Law Schools, is something that seems to be coming out at just the right moment.
Yeah. In fact, I was talking with Marlene earlier today, and she referred to you as the Richard Susskind of legal education. So
timing is everything. Praise.
Yes.
I did. So, like, if you could wave a magic wand, what would be the first thing that you would fix in terms of how today's law schools operate?
Yeah, so the book has got three big categorical suggestions, and I tried to limit myself to ones that are sort of at least theoretically possible. So the first is, and this is the most important, and if there's a single takeaway from the book, it's that law school cannot continue to grow more expensive year after year, more expensive than inflation. So law school has to become cheaper, and the students have to have less debt. And the book goes into great detail in the last 10 years. But for that story, you really need to go back all the way into the 80s. I mean, relentlessly, year after year, law school tuition has grown faster than tuition. And if something can't go on forever, it will not go on forever.
I have to say, as a victim of that, it is absolutely true.
Yeah. Well, I mean, unless you graduated this year, you're better off than the people who are still coming in now. Like, it's just continued on. It continued on in the teeth of a collapse in applications. It continued on in the worst market for law grads in at least since the 90s. And there just has not been any slowdown in it. So that's the first and most important takeaway from it. Second, I would really like to see law schools do a better job with technology. No, I'm not suggesting that law schools should become coding schools, and we're not equipped to do that, and there's nobody in the building who knows how to do that. And of course, no one's going to hire a lawyer to code anyways. But what I do think is super important is that law schools and law students work together and gain an understanding of how technology can streamline the practice of law, can routinize certain practices, and basically make the practice of law easier, simpler, and cheaper for the clients and the people at large. And then the last is the regulation of law schools. So historically, the ABA and state Supreme Courts have regulated law schools in the fancy term is what you call input regulations. So they've said, you know, what size faculty you have to have and what kind of work they have to do and what the law library is like, and like a checklist of things that they think makes a good law school, the inputs that go into it. And the new regulation is moving towards outputs. Basically, do your students get jobs? Do your students graduate? And do your students pass the bar? And so I am super enthusiastic about output regulations. That's the way we should be headed. And that's absolutely positively the most important thing. That will let 1,000 flowers bloom, and law schools can try different approaches to reach the things that the students who are paying this exorbitant tuition really, really care about.
So the Maoist version of law schools.
Yeah, although I add in a second caveat to that, which is don't be evil.
Don't be evil. Okay.
There are law schools, and it's not every law school, but there's been predatory behavior by a number of law schools. Yes. And you can see it just in terms of the bar passage and the job placement rates. They are letting people into school who are not going to succeed in law school or ever become lawyers. Yeah. And so if you're going to have output regulations, you have to have teeth with them and you have to really look out for them.
I wanted to pull back just a little bit. So you mentioned the three things that you would like to see happen. You also mentioned that there were originally three different styles of legal education over the years. And there was this apprenticeship model. There was a proprietary law schools, which were relatively very inexpensive. And then there was the Harvard model of scientific study of the law. And I think we know who won.
Yeah.
So what if anything, do you see as the flaw in teaching all of the legal education that we get in the U.S. based on this Harvard model?
Well, yeah. So let me start backwards just for a second.
Sure.
So at the dawn of the country, when we're first founded, everybody becomes a lawyer through apprenticeship.
Yes.
Then in the mid-19th century, you have Jacksonian democracy, and you had an attack on American elites, and you had a downgrading of American elites. And as you're experiencing right now in America, when you attack elites, lawyers are in the front row.
Right.
So Jacksonian democracy was actually, like, if it wasn't their biggest success, it's one of their top five successes, was they basically deregulated the legal profession. By the time the Civil War starts, two-thirds of states have no formal entry into the legal profession. And there's a bunch of states where anybody who's literate and a citizen can appear as a lawyer in court. So the Industrial Revolution comes, and there's a ramp back up amongst lawyers, and they decide now that they want to have entry into the profession and they want to reprofessionalize. So there's the old model of the apprenticeship model. And actually, weirdly, that would have been the easiest thing to do, right? Because that's what everybody already understood. But at the same time, you have this sort of growth in the scientific study of things. You have this German university model. And so the elites who were pushing this were like, you know what we should do is we should go ahead and push for scientific study of law. So that's the Harvard model there. But as you can imagine, and if you've been to an American law school, there's a little bit of fat in the budget. And so the proprietary law school sprung up basically to get people through the bar as quickly as possible. And the original model for it was the YMCA night school. And so just picture us, if you've been to a YMCA gym, just put a bunch of folding chairs in there and then put an adjunct professor at the front, and that's the school. And you can see that if you've got one or two permanent employees, that's a very inexpensive model. So there's basically this sort of three-way death cage match between these three different models. And it's the Harvard model that triumphs.
I'm picturing this right now.
Yes. Yeah, no, for sure.
Three models enter the octagon, only one survives.
Yes, no, absolutely. Yeah, and basically what happened was, actually in the 20s, it looked like the proprietary law schools weren't going to win. There's a huge growth in that area and limited growth in the sort of ALS/Harvard model. But the Depression changed everything. In the Depression, all of a sudden, there's much more interest in having fewer lawyers, basically. And there's also more interest in having better trained lawyers, et cetera, et cetera. And so state Supreme Courts come on board, and the ABA gets involved, and they just adopt the ABA accreditation standard. And basically, by the time World War II ends, that's the model. They've won, and that's what, you know, like a whole bunch of law schools closed between the Depression and the beginning of World War II, and almost all of them were the proprietary night schools. Oh, yeah. So what's the problem with that model?
Yeah.
It's a little bit like, why can't every car be a Rolls Royce? There's really not a need to have 204, 203 law schools with faculties, where full-time faculty that spend a bunch of time doing research and large law libraries and basically the type of build-out that we have here. And so, yeah, that's my main concern for it is that. And if this is one of the points that the book makes, which I think is sort of fun, is it's always been the case that law school in the Harvard model has been too academic and not practical enough. But that's not a mistake. That's the point of the model. Mm-hmm. The way the Harvard model won was by being more academic. So it's not like it's a side effect of an otherwise, you know, neutral thing. That's the entire purpose of the Harvard model.
Right.
So given that, is there a model that you'd like to see return to the education fold to become more popular?
Well, first, I mean, the output regulation rather than input regulation should really encourage this. If you're just measuring on whether people graduate, get jobs, and pass the bar, then you can remix things and do things in a very different style. And I am all for that. As far as I'm concerned, if you can hit those three benchmarks, then I'm open-minded to however you can do it. That being said, it's sort of obvious that you would want to do more to prepare people for practice. And the irony of it is actually that we're doing better at that now at ABA schools than we ever have. With the experiential requirement and the growth of clinical programs, the growth of externship programs, like we're actually on the right track with that. I just think that we are not done. That journey needs to continue.
What do you think about the idea of, if we're looking at jobs and graduates getting jobs, are we also looking at where and what types of jobs are out there that aren't being filled? And should that help dictate what type of model, like maybe the more practical model? Because, you know, we hear so much about, okay, we have all of this opportunity in terms of access to justice and all of these people need representation. But yet if you're, you know, if you're going to a law school with this Harvard model, you're not getting the practical experience. And, you know, you're also paying quite a bit of money that perhaps, you know, you can't pay back doing more of these practical types of roles.
I love that question. The last book, Rebooting Justice, is an access to justice book. And part of that book is this really, really puzzling dilemma at the heart of law schools and the access to justice crisis. How is it possible that basically one third of American law school graduates from 1990 to now are not working as lawyers, and roughly a third of law school graduates from that period weren't able to get a job as a lawyer at graduation? Now, some of those folks like went to law school and decided they didn't want to be lawyers. But that's like the data shows that's not the case for the majority of those folks. Most people go to law school because they want to be lawyers and are disappointed if they don't get a job as a lawyer. So there's this like weird underemployment gap. And so you would think that there would be all these lawyers anxious to serve this unmet need. So you're like, well, that doesn't make a lot of sense. Well, the reason why is that law schools teach the students to handle each case as like a little snowflake, as an individual project that has to be handled individually, which is the fancy word is a bespoke model. It's right. Like as if you're teaching people to tailor individualized suits rather than make a line of clothing.
Yep. We've already entered the Richard Susskind's bespoke.
Totally. Yeah. No, so that's a really, really, really expensive model, and that's the only model that we're teaching them. And so basically, there's all this unmet need, but the folks who have this need can't afford to spend $10,000 for a contested divorce or $15,000 for a DUI defense or even $1,000 for a will. People who are in the middle class or in the lower middle class, working poor folks, don't have a bunch of money sitting around paying for really desperately needed legal services. So the answer to this is we just need to teach the law schools it's fine to teach the individualized model, and it's fine to teach the most complicated law. That's the most lucrative law. I understand that. That being said, not all law has to be handled individually. Some of it can be broken apart in a simpler manner and done much more cheaply for many more people. And so that's my passion for access to justice and for legal education comes together on that point. And that's the technology point too. Like all three of those together form a world where we're training lawyers to serve more people for less money and make better money overall. Like there's a world where it works out to be a win-win-win for everybody.
I'm trying to think of things like I believe there was the Appalachian Law School. There was a pitch for a university or a law school in Tennessee that was supposed to help with serving the rural community. And as far as I remember, the ABA kind of shot both of those down.
So the Appalachian Law School made it. And was accredited and has failed as a business model. And I don't have it in front of me, but the tuition there is not reflective of that mission, in my opinion. I'm not like trying to single them out. And also the model is not reflective of that opinion. You can't bring people in and have them borrow you can't even have them borrow $25,000. You certainly can't have them borrow $100,000, $150,000, and then go out and serve a population where you say, I'm happy to help you. The average lawyer charges around $225 an hour. But even at $100 an hour, right, they're charging less than half of what the average lawyer charges. Like, that's just a brutal amount of money to ask somebody to do. Mm-hmm. And if you've been to law school or worked as a lawyer, 10 hours of legal work is just really not very much legal work. Like, you're not going to be able to get much done for that cost. And that's $1,000. Like, that's a lot of money to regular folks.
Even so, I have friends who are solo attorneys that in a good year, they don't make $80,000 a year.
Oh, I know. Right.
There's this disconnect. I just don't understand it.
Yeah, no, for sure. And there's a great study about how much time solos are able to actually bill out. And it's a really low number. It's like 2 or 3 hours a day.
Yeah.
And the crazy thing is, I'm with you, man. I mean, I work at University of Tennessee. I know a ton of graduates who are solos or working in small firms, what I call sort of the Main Street lawyers. And I promise you, they're not golfing 6 hours a day. It's a brutal, dog-eat-dog, super competitive market.
Yeah.
The reason they're not able to bill out more time is because they just spend a lot of time meeting with folks and saying, you can't afford me, you can't afford me. And that's a problem that we have to get over.
Like, it is.
Technology and law schools and these lawyers can work together to where they're reaching more folks.
So I wonder if some of the reason, and I'm probably going to get in trouble here, if some of the reason is, again, sort of based on this Harvard model, and there's, I don't know, a sense of elitism that we don't handle things like that. That's not what we were trained to do.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think part of it is, remember, so most of the professors at the schools, even the schools that are lower ranked or less prestigious, come from pretty prestigious backgrounds. they have practice experience. A lot of them have practice experience in big firms, or they have practice experience at relatively high level government work. And so you're completely right. Like, they're not really interested in talking about run-of-the-mill cases. And then in defense of them, they would say, well, you know, the more complex cases, the less run-of-the-mill cases, you know, we teach only cases.
And they're more interesting.
Right. They're more interesting. And also, yeah. You know, that's the lawyers who work in those cases make more money. But that being said, not everybody can work in that area. You know what I mean? Not everyone's going to be an antitrust lawyer or even a high-level tort lawyer. Lots of people are just going to do run-of-the-mill med mal cases. Mm. And so we have to work on educating those folks too.
Let me take the other side of that is, you know, my friends who are solos that an 80K year is a great year for them. They are also one of the first I see to fight the technology or the uniform or, you know, having the Bar Association come out with standardized forms that people can use because they're in fear that that's somehow taking lots of business away from them. So I think your whole thing about it doesn't have to be, not everything's a snowflake. I just don't think that people understand that.
Oh, no. So you've got that completely right. And note, basically, we're in a time of change and we're in a time of royal, and there are winners and losers that come through that for sure. And so I do not mean to downgrade that at all. Right. That being said, I give a talk on technology to the entire first year class every year for the last 5 years here at Tennessee. And I just go ahead and tell them, it's my opinion that the lawyers of the future who are going to make it are the ones who are really able to grasp this idea of simplification, routinization, and using technology to streamline things. And the folks who don't do that are really going to swim upstream. But then I note for the students, the good news on that, who's in better shape to do that? Somebody my age, somebody my dad's age, or somebody their age? Like, they're super fluent with technology. And again, we're not asking them to do any heavy lifting or programming. We're really just asking them, like, you know, don't have an office. Consider having fewer employees. And in the way that you do it, consider setting it up so that the clients interface with the machine as much or more than they interface with you. And so the whole point of it is that the lawyers do the hardest work, the work that only a human can do, the work they're best at, and honestly, probably the work they went to law school to do, right? Appearing in court, talking to clients, building legal arguments. All of the other stuff that comes along with running a small business, which is what being a solo practitioner is, they need to automate that as quickly and as conveniently as possible. So that being said, I'm with you. And in particular, if I were a 50-year-old who is scared of technology, then I would definitely want to fight that. But again, it's my opinion, they're doing it exactly backwards. LegalZoom and Rocket Lawyer and other online companies have little to no use for existing lawyers. And they're just working around the bar associations and these regulations every day. And so instead of like saying, oh, what we need to do is limit our ability to compete with them and just stick with the old way of doing it, that's just, in my opinion, that's not a successful strategy. And I don't say that based on just studying the legal profession. I say that just look at the march of technology since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. The folks who have been like, if I try and regulate it, surely it'll go away. That just hasn't worked out for them. And it's not a long-term survival mode. So, for example, the forms, we had a bunch of these fights in Tennessee. And in my opinion, again, they've got it backwards. Like, the lawyers are allowed to use the forms, too. Like, if there's a bunch of forms that are helpful for divorce, then instead of, you can still have contested divorces that can't be used for the forms. But for the folks who have a simpler divorce, lower your price, get more people in the door, and then do more divorces. Like, there's a version of this, again, where if you're flexible and nimble, you can do better, I think.
Yeah. Well, let me play off of your first year talk on technology. And so we've had on the show here a number of law schools that are doing these innovative ideas, whether they're the tech courses, integrating tech into the curriculum, practical skills training, innovation labs, those sorts of things.
Yep.
Are those actually making any type of an impact on the legal market as far as who's recruiting or job opportunities that are available for the students?
Oh, that's a great question. So I'll say two things about that. The first thing is, I'm teaching an A2J lab here that's basically a programming class It's the second year I've done it. And so in terms of the effect on those students, I think it's still too soon to tell because it's a really nascent area and we're basically equipping these students with a whole different skill set. And it's too soon to tell how that will play out early in their career, let alone as they go forward. In terms of the job placement, here's what I can say. There are a handful of jobs in these legal tech companies, and there are a handful of people who go out and just start legal tech companies. Mm-hmm. Short of that, I honestly think that it has not had that big an impact on hiring, which, as you can imagine, is of great frustration to me and to the folks who are involved with this. It is frustrating to me, but extra not surprising to me, because in my experience and my study of law school hiring, really not much that law schools do changes the behavior of employers. Employers really, really, really tend to hire based on the perceived prestige of the school and the perceived class rank within the school, and then some level of personal connection / recommendations from folks on the faculty.
And this is where we play the sad music.
but I'll point out, you know, statistically, none of that makes
an impact on
whether they're going to be a successful lawyer. Statistics are showing that. And I'll also mention, like, why don't we flip that question around? And will it be the students who are taught these things and who are familiar with these things that will basically go in and kind of forge their own way with solutions that are ultimately needed? You know, as you've said, you know, some of these other, you know, legal support organizations and companies, you know, they don't need lawyers. And, you know, is it really these students coming in as new practitioners that are really going to drive the innovation because they see the need in order to survive?
For sure. And that's what I meant by it's too soon to tell. We just don't know the answer to that, to how that's all going to work itself out. But yeah, I'm excited for that.
Cool. I'm sure it would be oversimplistic to think that fixing law schools are going to fix all the problems with the legal system in the U.S. But, you know, I think we're probably all in agreement that it's a start. What, Ben, do you see as the biggest problem facing the legal system in the United States? And how do you think that changing legal education might help address the bigger issues that we face as a society? That's a big question.
No, you're fine. The first thing I'll note is that law schools are a pinata, and that whenever there's a perceived problem in the profession, there's a strong temptation by the bar regulators to be like, well, you know, instead of actually making current lawyers do it, what we should do is make the law schools do it. Hmm. I mean, obviously you want to fix things that you're seeing out in the profession that need to be fixed, but that's not a be all and end all. The end result of all regulation should not just be yelling at the law schools. That being said, and I already talked about it a bunch, but it's the access to justice crisis aspect to things. And in particular, I would note, for years and years and years, I think people have perceived the access to justice crisis as just a problem for poor people. And that's a deep misunderstanding of the crisis. The crisis is that middle-class people and even upper-middle-class people can't really afford much legal services. At the same time, where we're in this like law thick world, as Jillian Hadfield calls it, where basically there's just law controls a lot of different aspects of our lives. And a lot of people, I mean, these are things like, you know, landlord-tenant law or divorce law or child custody law or debt relief. I mean, these are things that are really, really, really important where you can't afford a lawyer. And weirdly, in this situation, the working poor are way worse off than the like super poor. So, for example, in Knoxville, Tennessee, if you work full-time at McDonald's, you're too rich to qualify for a legal services corporation, and you're too rich to get a public defender. And so from there all the way up into the, you know, the middle class, people earn $50,000, $60,000, $70,000 a year, they just don't have access to legal services. And law schools have to be a part of that solution. We have to help the current students who are graduating think of ways to better serve that population. And that not only makes better sense for the country, that makes better business sense. Like, there's no reason why we should cede huge swaths of legal need to non-lawyers at LegalZoom and Rocket Lawyer. Like, we want those folks to come in and pay us to do that work. And we want to do that not because we force them to through unauthorized practice of law or licensing, but because we offer an awesome product that they want to purchase. Like, that's the actual answer to this. And law schools have to figure out how they can be part of that solution.
So, Ben, to finish up, I wanted to do just a quick round with you, and I'm going to throw out some concepts or some players within the legal industry, and
yep.
just real quick, and we'll see how this works out. Ask you to give a quick answer on how you think they could change or influence how the law schools operate. So, I'm going to start.
This is
with
a lightning round. It's a lightning round.
So, I'm going to start with the big one. The American Bar Association.
Okay, so hold on. I'm going to be even more lightning roundy.
All right.
I have your list in front of me, and I'm going to lump some together. Are you ready?
Okay, I'm ready.
Do it.
ABA, state bars, federal, state, and local government.
All right, go.
The state Supreme Court in every state in the nation is basically the government body that controls lawyer regulation. And it's the state Supreme Court that has basically empowered both state bars and the ABA to be the regulators of the law schools. You can't just pick the ABA because they're actually the actual bodies that are doing it are these individual government bodies. Now, it's funny you would put the ABA first because your impression would be like, oh, no, the ABA basically runs that. And that's true. That's because the state Supreme Courts have another job. They're really busy. So they don't have a lot of time to sort of like really deeply manage or keep track of that. But part of the idea would be to get all of those bodies on board, and in particular to have all of those bodies on board with output regulations with real teeth. Okay. And that's the combination of the two things that you just desperately need.
All right. Now, big law firms, what can big law firms do to help with the legal education?
Yeah, and so this goes back to the hiring thing. I would just love to see more rational hiring, because basically, if you're just going to do hiring based on the ranking of the school and the ranking of the people within the school, it's almost like what happens at the school is utterly meaningless. And that means that trying to change anything at the school is really hard, because if you say, oh, we're going to focus much more on experiential education, or we're going to have a required clinical program, or we're going to have like truly focus on having practice ready graduates, and then it doesn't move the needle at all in terms of hiring, and later we'll get the law students, or in terms of applications, then you're like, why bother? You know what I mean? Like, this is part of the reason why law schools hurt so much, is because there's frequently not much upside to changing. And sometimes the schools that are more aggressive in changing are actually punished by it.
Right. Rational hiring. That's the name of my new punk band.
So. Ah, I like it.
All right. Did you want to lump the next ones, or is there anything you want to
lump
together?
Yeah, man, let's do deans and professors together for
sure. All right. So law school deans and law school professors, what can they be doing?
There's a really funny Chronicle of Higher Ed article that I talk about in the book. And it's 2013 or 14. It's right in the middle of the big crisis. It's when first year applications are collapsing, and there's like 33% fewer people in the building. And what are they going to do for the funding? And I'm paraphrasing the headline, but the headline is, law school deans find law school faculties puzzlingly resistant to change.
Hey.
Which made me laugh super hard. I was like, oh, I'm not puzzled by that at all. These people have not spent enough time at a law school faculty meeting. I'm not trying to speak only about my own institution, but my experience here and elsewhere is there's no shortage of good ideas. In fact, in terms of low-hanging fruit, there's like low-hanging fruit, there's fruit on the ground, we're stepping on fruit, we're surrounded by fruit. Yes. Everyone's got a bunch of ideas about how to fix it, but what we need to do is have flexibility and the ability to work together with it. It's a really crappy time to be a law school dean, because if the tuition and budget model is still messed up, and then you have people like me who are like, oh, but you can't, you know, you have to make it cheaper. And they're like, oh, you know, I've just finished going through the last 10 years, which is really brutal. It's a bad time to ask for more, but that's what we need to do. We need to have more. More in terms of cheaper schools, better schools, and the faculty has to get on board with that.
I'm going to do just a quick little side note here, a side question. What about the problem that we're hearing with overuse of adjunct faculty? Are you seeing any problems in that area?
So again, and this will be unpopular with some listeners, but I'm an output regulations guy. And so if a school is using a bunch of adjunct faculty, but people are graduating and they're getting jobs and they're passing the bar, then I'm a little confused about what the problem is. Like, those are the things that really, really matter to the students. And so in my opinion, that's what should matter to the school. So that being said, this is what I mean by output regulations with teeth. Like, if you're replacing all of your current faculty with adjunct faculty, and then people are failing the bar on this and not able to get jobs, then that's definitely not okay.
I was going to say, I'm going to lump the next two together. In fact, I'm going to add one.
Great.
Law students, law school applicants, and then I'm going to add law school alumni.
Oh, I like this. Okay. So students and applicants, I would prefer to see applicants be savvier consumers. The studies show that law school applicants choose first and foremost based on the U.S. News ranking, and then a distant second to that is location and programmatic things. Mm-hmm. And so I would, like, the same way I'm sad about the way hiring is done out of law school, it's how I feel about how the students choose. Like, gotcha. I feel like they should dig in deeper. And the ABA, to their credit, the amount of data that you can get on individual law schools is jaw-dropping. Like, you can get a really, really in-depth, like, granular description of bar passage and job placement down to the exact types of jobs that people are getting out of the school and what their average earning is. So I would just prefer to see the students working hard to differentiate between the schools, because that would actually help the schools. If the way that the schools are being chosen is based on U.S. News, and that's all the schools are going to care about. And then the underlying data will only be jiggered to try and move up or down in U.S. News, which, of course, has not gotten us very far.
And it is.
Totally.
That's exactly what's
right.
happening.
And that's just that's the tail. That's not even the tail. It's like some part of the tail wagging the entire rest of the dog. It's a really bad situation. And again, you know, they're applicants, so I understand where they're coming from. But that would be my hope.
And what about alumni?
Yeah, I would hope that alumni would be supportive of the school going forward and making changes, basically. Like, I would like to see alumni recognizing that technology is part of the solution. And also, I would really like to see the alumni buck up on the tuition and the debt. It just seems like the alumni as a whole, and I'm speaking generally, it's not like I have a whole bunch of data to back this up, but it's not my sense that there's an alumni revolt on how things are going with tuition. And that's a shame. I mean, in particular, you know, like at University of Tennessee, I ran into a guy. I gave a talk at Nashville yesterday, and I asked the guy what his tuition was when he came here in the 80s, and he was like, $200 a quarter. I was like, I bet that's working out for you. He was like, ha, 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 sure did. And so I would really like to hear that guy call up the dean and sweat her about our current tuition, and not just here, yeah. Our tuition. I mean, I'm not trying to pick on Tennessee, but I'm just saying all over the country, the alumni should be asking questions about that.
Yeah, that's I think really what I hear is, well, I feel sorry for the people that are in there now, but, you know, hey, it's their choice. So, but yeah, I
had
you're right.
to do it, you know, yeah. So they have to do it.
So the last one is, what can we be doing more with technology and innovation to fix law schools?
Yeah. So we talked a bunch about this,
yeah.
But the A2J lab class that I teach and that they're teaching at a bunch of other law schools is based on this particular skill that American law schools are currently not very good at teaching. And so the skill is taking a legal problem and simplifying it, breaking it apart into constituent parts, putting it in the order that makes the most sense, and then asking a regular person questions, basically at like a second grade or third grade reading level, to help them create either a legal document or a legal process. And if you just think about how that works, like the learning the law and then breaking it apart and then regularizing it, we spend much, much more time on gray areas we're not capable of doing that. But we need to do both of those things. We need to teach people about how to simplify the law and routinize it. And that's both a conceptual thing, but that's also a technology thing. Because once you break it apart into constituent parts, then you can let technology do a bunch or all of the work for you.
All right. Well, that's the end of the lightning round.
Beautiful. I like it.
Well, Ben, I want to tell our listeners that your book, Fixing Law Schools from Collapse to the Trump Bump and Beyond, is out now. Right now.
right now
for a holiday present. People can get it.
It actually physically was released yesterday, so you've got me on the right day.
Yes, right. So it can be ordered through Amazon or other book outlets, and I believe the Kindle version is coming out next week. Is that right?
Yep, that's right.
Oh, good. So, Ben, thank you so much for taking the time.
No, thank y'all. It was a great conversation. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, I think this was very informative and very thought-provoking. So, thank you.
Absolutely. Yeah, thanks again, Ben.
All right, appreciate it.
So, it's going to be interesting to see if Ben's predictions about law schools are as successful as Richard Susskind's have been regarding the legal field. I think he's right that you need different models to satisfy different needs. And this complements an idea that we've discussed before, different courses or tracks of study depending on what you want to do. Mm. I'd like Ben's idea even more because an entire school could be devoted at the correct price point for particular tracks, whether the focus is on the more practical aspects of representation or legal tech support or something else. You could still support the Delta lawyer model this way too.
Yeah, the one thing that I worry about is whether or not the horse has left the barn, especially when it comes to price, because I don't see the schools getting back to a reasonable price. Maybe I'm wrong, but we'll have to see how that plays out. But I really liked his concept of taking the legal process and breaking it into the natural processes, which happens in practicing law. And not everything is a special one-off or, as he called it, a snowflake. So find out what can be automated, what can be delegated, and what can maybe even be deleted in the processes. You know, be able to do more, charge less, and end up making as much or more at the end of the day. So while law schools may still be the whipping boy for what is seen as wrong in our legal industry and culture, there are definitely pieces in which Professor Ben Barton points out that can be improved. It was great having him on the show. So go out and get that book as a Christmas gift for yourself or for your favorite legal professional out there who's looking to make this industry a little bit better.
Well, that wraps up our podcasting for 2019, and we look forward to seeing all of you in 2020. But before we go, we want to remind listeners to take the time to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Rate and review us as well.
Yeah, consider that your Christmas gift to us.
Your holiday gift to us.
There you go.
If you have comments about today's show or suggestions for a future show, you can reach us on Twitter at Gaybauer M or at Glambert, or you can call the Geek and Review hotline at 713-487-7270 or email us at geekandreviewpodcast@gmail.com. And as always, the music you hear is from Jerry David DeSica. Thank you, Jerry.
Thanks, Jerry. All right, Marlene, safe travels over the holidays.
Thank you. You too. Merry, merry.